The joint meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committee will now come to order. It is 1:35, Monday, January 25, in the State Capitol, Room 25. I am Representative Ledoux, and this is Senator Coghill, and I will be chairing this hearing today, but Senator McGuire, the Senate Judiciary Chairman, is not going to be here, so Senator Coghill will take her place today. So, Senator Coghill, would you like to introduce your members to begin
with? Sure. I'm the spare tire, Senator Coghill. I'm the stand-in for somebody who, unfortunately, just cannot be here today. Senator Wilkowski is here with us today. Senator Costello is here with us today. And Senator Coghill, which constitutes a majority. We're missing one other, so... thank you for inviting us to this, and we look forward to the hearing.
And again, I am Representative Ledoux, and we have from the House Judiciary Committee, we have Representative Clayman, we have Representative Lynn, and we have my Vice Chair, Representative Keller, with us. We have two items on the agenda today. First, we'll be hearing from Mike O'Brien, who is the Assistant General Counsel at UAF. He will be speaking about the University of Alaska's federal Title IX compliance pursuant to some reports of issues handling sexual assault cases on the University of Alaska campuses. Second, we will be hearing from Department of Corrections Commissioner Walt Monaghan. The commissioner had begun his new role just before our interim hearing on the Department of Corrections administrative report, so we've invited him back today for an update. I would also like to say that while today is invited testimony only, I do intend to schedule another meeting to hear from the Correction Officers Association to hear their perspectives and recommendations regarding this report. Finally, members will find two additional items on their desks. Mr. O'Brien has provided a half sheet on Title IX, and I have shared a Wall Street Journal article pursuant to this topic. Mr. O'Brien, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin. And I'd also like to note that Representative Grunberg has joined us. He's already provided the donuts that he provided that for being late a previous meeting.
You don't get them for today. Anybody can have anybody who wants.
Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you for having me. My name is Michael O'Brien. I'm an Associate General Counsel for the University of Alaska System. I'm here today to talk about three things with you. One, a background on Title IX and sexual assault regulation across the United States at universities and colleges. Two, some specific problems at UAF that you've probably heard about and how they've been addressed. And third, how the university is handling and being accountable for compliance for sexual assault on our campuses going forward. I don't need to tell all of you that sexual assault is a tremendous problem in the state of Alaska. It's a problem also at all universities. It's a problem at UA. It's a problem at Yale, at West Point, at BYU, at Cal Berkeley. It doesn't matter the way a school is administered, its makeup, its ideology, how the students are organized, sexual assault is a problem in those communities across our country. You've probably learned that UAF came forward recently to proactively discuss problems on its campus involving several cases of sexual assault that were mishandled in their student discipline process.
Mr. O'Brien,
yeah.
When you use the term sexual assault,
yeah.
Do you mean sexual assault basically the same thing that we talk about in the statutes when we're talking about sexual assault, or is there a broader definition as far as the university is concerned?
I guess both, if I can have it both ways. Sexual assault, at its most basic term, what I'm talking about is rape, which I think we need no further definition. Title IX is interested, and I'll get to why this is, with sexual harassment, and the federal government regulates sexual assault or rape as a form of sexual harassment, which seems like kind of counterintuitive, but that's how the university is regulated to think of sexual harassment. Because sexual harassment can have so many meanings, it can be verbal, it can be a quid pro quo in a workplace environment, it can be sexual assault. I use the term, and the university uses the term, sexual misconduct to kind of talk about this in a soup-to-nuts approach of anything inappropriate going on involving gender or sexual identity discrimination. So it can mean a lot of things, but when I say sexual assault, I'm talking about rape.
Thank you.
So, again, UAF came forward proactively this fall to talk about problems involving sexual assault or rape on its campus in the past. And to put that in context, I'd like to start by giving all of you some history and background on Title IX and how it is that universities are where they are right now, where we're so laser-focused on sexual misconduct in our campuses. So Title IX as a federal law is quite old. Richard Nixon signed it into law in 1972. Many of you, like many Americans, think of Title IX, you think of sports, in particular women's inclusion in sports. So literally leveling the playing field for women on college and university campuses and making the number of teams available to them equal to men's, and the amount of funding available to women's sports gain parity with that of men's sports. And that is what Title IX was for about 25 years of its existence. It wasn't until the turn of this century that Title IX legally changed to schools looking not just at access to educational programs like sports, but actually getting involved with harassment on their campuses.
So, Mr. O'Brien, when you say that the law changed, mm-hmm. did the law change because Congress changed the law, or is this simply because the people who were handling Title IX for the federal government, they decided to interpret it in a different way than it had been interpreted in the past?
I keep doing this, but both. So in 1997, the Supreme Court decided in a case called Davis that persistent and insidious harassment in the educational environment fell under Title IX. So the law actually changed. Title IX exists in federal law, but the vast majority of what I'm talking to all of you about is something that we get through guidance. Now, it's guidance from the organization that gives universities the lion's share of their funding. So it's very persuasive guidance. But the Department of Education followed that Supreme Court case by saying, yes, you've probably read this case. We are now telling you as well that it's now your business, schools and universities and colleges, to look into harassment and to deal with harassment on your campuses.
Amen.
Senator Bukaka.
If I might ask the question, the group that gives you the guidance,
right.
Just give us a high-level view of who that might be.
So ultimately, the Department of Education, they have an enforcement wing called the Office of Civil Rights.
Okay.
And the Office of Civil Rights has been getting the majority of press lately. They've been issuing the guidance that I'll come to very quickly. Has been a tectonic shift in how universities handle sexual misconduct and on their campuses. So.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Lind.
Thank you very much for coming here. Very important subject. Could you tell me, please, when does simple flirtation or flirting turn into harassment?
When it becomes extreme. So extreme and pervasive that it causes the other person, the recipient, to leave the educational environment.
Is there anything between that and just, I mean, they have to leave the school because the flirtation has exceeded what it would normally be?
They don't have to leave, but in essence, a reasonable person would want to leave at that point. The goal of Title IX is to not deny students educational opportunities because of some sort of sexual or gender discrimination going on. So, no, flirtation is not something that's going to violate Title IX, but when it gets to the point where the object of that flirtation is so repelled that they'd rather leave class and not come anymore, they would rather drop out than see the person anymore, that's clearly a situation where the university is tasked with taking action.
Thank you. Good answer.
So is it the reasonable person test, or is it like in a tort, that it's you take the victim as you find them? So if somebody is particularly sensitive, how does that work?
Well, you know, obviously people aren't viewing their own lives through the lens of a reasonable person. We'd have a very different country if they did. People view their lives through the lens of their own experiences. People come to us as an individual, and much of the time dealing with Title IX cases is empowering people to say, you know, this behavior isn't severe. You need to decide if you want to say something in response or tell the person to stop or avoid it. You know, for example, what's harassing to one person is just something I don't agree with to someone else. So the universities are put in this tough position because we are the marketplace of ideas, and part of that marketplace is uncomfortable ideas, ideas we others object to, and ideas that, to be blunt, offend other people, but just because they offend other people doesn't per se make them harassing. But obviously, Senator Lynn, his observation is that there's a spectrum here where we have to, that the university finds itself looking on that spectrum. Is this flirtation, or is it so pervasive that it's actually pushing someone out of the educational environment?
If Representative.
Sorry.
Yes, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you get this advice from OCR, does it change the role of the university, or change it, or, I mean, help me understand, I guess, the role of the university? Is a guidance that you get involved in the enforcement? I mean, there's a comment here in the handout that talks about that a complaint is by the preponderance of the evidence is when there's a determination made of, I guess, guilt or innocence. But what is that puts you in a spot, right, where you can take some kind of enforcement action, right. I would assume, like moving somebody around or to take them out of a class or whatever. It just seems odd to me, because is that based on in the process? Is a court involved here in this, or who decides the preponderance of the evidence? That kind of guidance.
Sure. Jumping ahead a little bit, in 2011 there was new guidance came out that outlines exactly what you're asking about, and it was a tectonic shift in how universities dealt with this issue. We went from a place where often, for example, sex assault was seen as a police matter, and we'd let them a police investigation run its course before making determination. That 2011 guidance from OCR was very clear that universities no longer have that discretion, period. Universities now, through their student conduct process, which UA has always had a student conduct process, Title IX or no Title IX, through that student conduct process, UA has to, on parallel with the criminal investigation, look at how look at an event and determine by a preponderance of the evidence, which, as we know, is different from the criminal process, whether that person has violated the student code of conduct. So the university's power is limited, you know, to our boundaries and letting someone be a student. And what are the terms of their being a student? So by a preponderance of the evidence, for example, for the most extreme conduct, such as sexual assault, there's, through Border Regents process, there's a due process hearing, and a person can be removed from our community. So we are in the place of investigating and then adjudicating whether a person can exist within our, can remain within the university environment. And so that's for the most extreme. For, say, flirtation that has had a harassing effect, the same sort of investigation is going to occur, but it's unlikely that that person's going to be suspended or expelled.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, surprising, answer at some level, because it just seems like the role of the university, is really being changed. So my question is, in light of the course and everything, my question is, has this resulted then in lawsuits, I would presume, people reacting negatively?
Well, not lawsuits, but, legal action, people attain law, where in the past it was somewhat rare that lawyers were involved with the student discipline process. It's now very common.
In Alaska?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
I should.
My understanding is nationwide, but that's my experience in Alaska, that it's become that 2011 guidance, one of the things it did, and it's many hundreds of pages looking at it, interpreting it, but one of the things it does is it removed an informality to how these were dealt with, and it made it very formal. And when you have a formal process, that's likely to attract lawyers.
A representative claimant.
So, as I understand it, there was a big incident at Duke University involving lacrosse players.
Right.
So, as I understand it, that involved allegations of sexual assault, rape, and that case was eventually brought in criminal court with a criminal prosecution, and just one defendant at least was acquitted. And you're saying that in a similar scenario, they don't have lacrosse at UAF, but in a similar scenario, a student that was accused of having raped another student could face both a administrative proceeding within the university, and if the university concluded that they had raped this other student, they would be expelled from the university, and that would be, even if they went to a criminal trial and the defendant was found not guilty in the criminal proceeding.
That's exactly right. It's akin to the way DMV works. If you're in a car accident and you harm someone, DMV, their power is to decide administratively who has a driver's license. You're going to have a DMV hearing, and they may revoke your license. You may be acquitted criminally somewhere down the road, but those are unhinged processes, and they're really answering two different questions. The Department of Motor Vehicles isn't asking whether you were under the influence or not under the time. They're coming to a conclusion whether you should have a license right now. So those are two different processes, and this is akin to that.
Follow up through the chair. What is that doing in terms of university resources? Because the reason I ask is that in theory, the university is there to provide education and for people to learn, and of course they've got dormitories and other things that are going on, but it seems like this is putting this huge investigative duty upon the university that 10 or 15 years ago they didn't have.
Correct. 3 years ago they didn't have. 4 years ago they didn't have. And now to have every university, every college has to have a Title IX coordinator, Title IX investigators, other support staff. So it's millions of dollar investment to comply with this.
So when you broke off to answer questions, you'd mentioned this term due process. And we talked a little bit about that in my office before we went to this meeting. My understanding from you is that this due process hearing that the university gives to those who have been accused of sexual assault or sexual behavior doesn't allow the accused to cross-examine the accuser, which actually in my mind under those scenarios doesn't sound very much like due process. Mm-hmm. Am I correct on that? And do you have to do? I mean, is this something that the feds are requiring you to do, not to allow people to cross-examine their accusers?
Would you mind if I just backed up a little bit and gave some history and how we got to this place, but I promise you I'll answer your question.
Okay.
So after the turn of the last century and in the years preceding it, one of the problems on college campuses was that in a case of a sexual assault, universities were completely deferential to the criminal process, often to the point where a alleged victim would have to sit in class next to the alleged perpetrator because they didn't want to take any action against that person. They didn't want to separate them out of the dorms together. So the pattern that emerged was that women in particular left colleges. They didn't just leave the educational environment, but they left with debt. They left with, you know, scholarships unused. So there's a real problem of, in essence, over-deference. That was the problem that was seen by the federal government. Again, we got this. We got received guidance in 2011 that required of universities to have a tectonic shift and to give victims a participation in the administrative process, to lower the burden of proof to the preponderance of evidence, to make the process more formal, and so that there wasn't a lot ability to kind of ignore these problems until one of the students went away. Along with that guidance was an effort to remove barriers to participation for alleged victims. And in particular, universities would often say, well, you can go forward with this, but you're going to have to sit in a room with this guy and let him cross-examine you or this girl. You can go forward with this, but we're going to have to try mediation first. From the federal government's perspective, all of those requirements that required that sort of confrontation had a chilling effect on women on college campuses in particular from coming forward in essence, prosecuting this matter. So, yes, there is, to answer your question now, there is guidance to avoid that. Second, if you look at Alaska state law, the standards for the University of Alaska established by the Alaska Supreme Court do not require a court-like atmosphere, don't require cross-examination, don't require any of the hallmarks of a criminal or civil trial before we take action to protect the university community. So that's not just the guidance, which is very, very clear. It's also the Alaska Supreme Court interpreting our Constitution.
You use this term guidance.
Right.
So what exactly, when guidance is coming from a huge funder, what does guidance actually mean?
Obviously, it's very persuasive. It is just guidance, and the issue of, because the effects of that guidance have effects on people's interest in going to school, this issue is being litigated, not in Alaska, but it's unclear exactly how closely universities have to follow it. There's a movement to have them not follow it at all. But the federal government's perspective is very clear that there's an expectation that we follow this guidance.
You know, I actually find it kind of scary that a young man, at the beginning of his life, could be accused of some sort of misconduct, and without the ability to cross-examine his accuser, could be thrown out of school. I mean, that's going to destroy somebody. I just find that very much of concern.
Well, there is process in place. It's not as if a person accused of something like this doesn't have not just an opportunity but several opportunities to state their case. It's just not, we're not required to have a trial. We're told not to have a trial, and we don't have that sort of cross-examination environment.
Senator Coghill.
Well, first of all, thank you, and I know that in recent months we've had some things come to light that showed the need for this very thing. So can you give us examples of how this has worked in Alaska?
Sure, and maybe I'll touch on briefly what exactly was disclosed at UAF and what the problem was there and how it's been dealt with. As I said, in 2011, in essence, the rules of the game changed. And the very things we're discussing came into effect, and universities started looking at how they were handling sexual misconduct on their campuses. You might have seen John Krakauer wrote a book called Missoula, a very compelling read, but it's about this very issue, how University of Montana did not follow that letter, did not follow guidance that had been given, and had some very significant problems on its campus, resulting in both Office of Civil Rights and the Department of Justice coming not only onto their campus, but taking over their district attorney's office as well.
One moment. Senator Winnicott.
I have to leave. I have a budget subcommittee starting it, too, but I didn't want anything else walking. I appreciate your testimony. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The case at University of Montana and documented in the book Missoula was indicative that many schools were not closely reading that 2011 guidance. And in 2014, a list was put out by the Office of Civil Rights. Normally, this would be a fantastic list to be on. You had Harvard, Harvard Law, UC Berkeley, Princeton, Michigan, University of Virginia, the best universities in the United States. The problem is it was a list of folks who were accused of violating their students' civil rights regarding sexual assault. I think most universities that weren't on the list, including ours, breathed a sigh of relief. The problem is 5 days later, the University of Alaska was put on that list for a review of our handling of sexual misconduct. We, as a result of that audit, that review, we produced 12,000 pages of documents. The lion's share of it was a retrospective look at how we'd handled cases of sexual misconduct, Title IX cases, harassment, since 2011. At the same time, it started to emerge that there may be problems in how student conduct was being handled at UAF. Because we now had this data set that we had given to the federal government as part of this audit, we audited ourselves, in essence. We audited UAF and found that out of 44 sexual harassment cases at UAF, there were 5 sexual assault cases, so serious cases, that although UAF had done many, many things right, they had provided interim services like class changes and escorts and changing the dorm rooms and trespass orders. While they'd done many things right for those alleged victims, they hadn't carried through and given the due process necessary, that final bit of due process to decide whether this person should be in our community. So they had not initiated what's called the major sanction process to either suspend or expel the alleged perpetrator. So in those cases, that hadn't been done. As a follow-up...
Had these people that... They'd gone through the criminal system. What had happened to their criminal cases?
Some had, some hadn't. So some are in jail. Some charges were pressed but not taken by the DA. Because remember, there's a beyond a reasonable doubt standard versus a preponderance standard. Some cases, no charges have ever been pressed. So there's 5 cases where that final stage of due process hadn't been fully gone through.
When you say due process, I mean, I always think about due process as, you know, the rights of the accused. Mm-hmm. But so when you say due process, you don't mean that the rights of the accused hadn't been considered. You mean that the procedure hadn't been.
Well, both, in that under how we view things, that the victim has a right to go through that process as well, and in essence prosecute the person who's he or she is accusing. So the student discipline process hadn't gotten to its end result.
Okay.
in either direction in these cases. After finding these 5 cases that were problematic, UA then did an audit of its entire system, because UA is not just UAF, and looked at UAA and UAS, because they're also doing student discipline. There, obviously, as we've already touched on, this is an area where there's a lot of regulatory compliance, and our own policies, and there were paperwork or technical issues in terms of how things were handled at UAA and UAS, but not at the level of where they were at UAF, where the process just kind of stopped without any kind of fruition. So as a result of that, once UAF had an opportunity to get its arms around the process, it's reinitiated those processes in those five cases. So where the ball was dropped, it's restarted it. And to its credit, UAF is the only school in the entire United States that has proactively come forward and talked about deficiencies prior to OCR coming out with its results. So many schools have said, oh, sorry, you know, mea culpa, we've made mistakes. But for anyone who has done that, it's after the federal government has already shown that they've made mistakes. UAF's disclosure came, we don't know when the Office of Civil Rights is going to come out with its report, but UAF's decision to come forward was a way to start the change, start the healing process on its own proactively.
Senator Dukakia.
First of all, I appreciate that, and I know that all of the campuses in Alaska, you're really interested in making them a safe, better mm-hmm. place. So I appreciate you being proactive. And though there's questions on fairness on across the board, we'll try to work with you on it. But in the process of your testimony, there are several things that come to my mind that maybe you could help us address. What we're assuming here is there are peer-to-peer classmates. That's what we're assuming, at least in the conversation we've had so far. But you have upperclassmen, lowerclassmen, that is not a peer-to-peer, at least from the perspective of institutional wisdom, put it for the best we can put it. We also have employee-student relations. Can you explain to us, as you've been proactive, how you've dealt with those two issues, the upperclassmen and then the employee-student relation?
Sure. Title IX applies to any, it's the entire educational environment, so it applies whether it's faculty on faculty problems, faculty on student, student on student, third party coming onto campus and assaulting or discriminating against a student. So it's the entire boundary of the campus, whoever is present on it. And you're hitting on an important point of being proactive. We've had done a lot of training, and this goes to Representative Clammon's question. It's cost a lot of money, but over 90% of faculty and staff are trained in how to handle, you know, first of all, if a student comes to them. What is the term used is trauma-informed, meaning how do you deal with a person who's gone through with this or gone through this? And also talking about, you know, just general discrimination and harassment in the workplace and in the classroom.
Senator Kagan.
Another point. So as the representative chairman brought up, how do we protect both, right? So what is the filtering process in this Title IX or in the way you have handled it through your proactive measures on creating either mean-spirited or frivolous accusations so that you don't destabilize the whole population?
Let me try and answer your question and tell me if I don't get it right. But again, it's training, and students are now getting trained as soon as they walk in the door. And the goal is to talk to them about harassment and discrimination in a way that doesn't offend our other really important pillar of the university, which is freedom of speech. You know, we want people to be careful about what they say, but not so much so that it's no longer the marketplace of ideas. And teaching, that's a foreign concept to a lot of students. Not only do we have to teach them that balancing act, but we find that students enter as freshmen not necessarily knowing something that maybe we all take for granted, like what consent is.
Right.
You know, consent seems obvious, but you know, for example, incapacitation is not consent. And that's an important lesson to teach, and it's not one that everyone knows. So we have had to spend quite a bit of time teaching that, especially, as you say, right off off the bat, because studies that we rely on show that that first semester of a student's college career between move-in day and Thanksgiving is what they call the red zone, meaning it's a time of increased vulnerability. And so we really need to get to students as soon as possible. And this is something they're getting, they're seeing as soon as they walk in the door.
And Madam Chair,
there's
only one other thing. And I know that we live in interesting times, in that what some people might call political correctness or really normal shifts in our society. We have assumed here it's male versus female, but there's a lot of same-sex type of pressure that happens in a university campus, probably as much as any place in the world. So we've assumed male versus female, but in the same-sex world, it's something else. Do you find that it's an open discussion, or is that throttled back?
It's an open discussion, and I think incoming students at the university are very open to that notion, and we have cases of male-on-male cases, female-on-female cases. So there's no – the only thing that causes rape is rapists. And so the issue of stopping it is one of empowering students to be able to step in and what we call bystander awareness. A Green Dot program is a big part of this, where students feel comfortable saying, maybe you shouldn't spend the night here, maybe you should come back to the dorms. Whereas in the past, the notion of, well, they're free to make their own decision would have ruled the day. And so just teaching students to look out for each other is part of this.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So when we talk about lack of consent due to incapacitation because somebody is drunk, does that mean that they're actually unconscious, or maybe they're making a decision to say yes when they're drunk that they might have said no if they weren't drunk?
That is a that's a problem that haunts many cases. I'd go back to what I said. Only rapists cause rape. I mean, we're not going to say because you were drunk, anything that followed from that was consent. That would wildly be inappropriate. And, you know, you look at places where, you know, for example, there's no access to alcohol, no clear ideological control, and very tight controls over the campus environment, like West Point, BYU. They have sexual assault problems. So it's while alcohol is a correlating factor with many of these cases, you know, the thing that's causing it is there are some people in our community who do not understand proper boundaries and consent. So that's where the focus of a lot of the training goes.
Now, I asked the question because I think you had mentioned incapacitation.
Right.
And so I wanted to try to figure out what exactly is incapacitation for purposes of Title IX.
I see. Well, we have, you know, as part of this process, you know, and this guidance, we've updated our university regulations, and we've had to define what is consent and have a written policy that we hand students and provide students right up front. So it's, you know, the ability to say yes or no, but it's also whether someone's able to perceive. Basically, if you say yes in a state of heightened drunkenness, that is not true consent.
Well, that's interesting. So what's heightened drunkenness?
Well,
I mean, half the sex in college gets done under probably conditions which would be viewed as heightened drunkenness.
Yeah. And that, so obviously there's a spectrum, and we often find ourselves, when we're looking at whether what happened is appropriate or not, having to make exactly that determination. So when you lose control of your limbs, when you can't stop vomiting, when you can't talk, when you can't stay awake, that's at the point where you're no longer legally, under our regulations, able to give consent.
Absolutely appropriate.
So if you're just drunk, and a reasonable person would think you're drunk, you know, often people regret sex they have when they're intoxicated. That doesn't ipso facto make it sexual assault. And so finding that gap in between is often very difficult, and that's one of the hurdles of determining what happens in these cases, because clearly we're not present when it happens, and often everyone who is present is, you know, has been drinking. So it can be quite difficult for exactly the reasons you raise.
I think Senator Coggio and then Representative Keller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So from 2011 to 2014 began kind of the education process, the being aware, but from 2014 to now, we have taken it to a new level in UAF or UAA.
Right.
So I guess one of the questions, if I was going to send my youngster to the university, the first thing I'd ask is it a more tense or more relaxed atmosphere because of these rules? Because I think inadvertently we can create the fear factor of, you know, my speech is going to be so scrutinized, my actions are going to be so scrutinized, I don't know if I want to go there. So from maybe the legal perspective, you can see if it has made people a little more relaxed in freedom, or if it's made them more tense and less freedom. Or is that an administrator question?
Right. Students are definitely this is in their face the moment they walk on campus. There's signs about it. They're educated about it. There's no question that we're taking it very seriously. The response, you know, and obviously I'm an administrator at the university, so that's gotten to me has been positive. But to me, the statistic that, you know, is this worth it? Is this a good thing? Sex assault in particular is an act where people don't want to report it, and rightfully so. It's a horrific thing. It's humiliating, and there's many situations where there's a question whether the person's going to be taken seriously. And where questions, you know, and I think these are valid questions, but, well, how much had you had to drink, can be translated into blaming the victim. Like I said, the university is taking this very, very seriously. And in the end, student safety is where the rubber meets the road. We can take it as seriously as we want. We can have as many programs as we want. But if students aren't actually more comfortable coming forward, you know, in essence, who cares? What we've seen is that the numbers of reports of people coming in and talking about this have gone up 300-400% in a year or two. So that's kind of counterintuitive that, oh, our numbers on sex assault and sexual misconduct are way up. But we know this is so wildly underreported that we know it's happening and we don't know it. But when our numbers are going up that much, 300% in a year, that means that students on the most sensitive topic are feeling that, yes, the university is taking this seriously. Someone is going to do something about it if I tell them. And in the end, I'd say that's the most telling statistic of our success on this area.
And then, Chair, that's a conversation I'll have with student leaders when they show up. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, it's actually a little series of questions, but the question I had when I saw the agenda come out was why? You know, why are we doing it? This is a year to budget. You know, we got deficits, we got all this, and I just was trying to follow the money. And I, as you were talking, I was thinking of how much it cost the university to produce 12,000 pages in response to the OCR fingering of University of Alaska with evidently no, well, I forget the term.
No findings.
Yeah, no findings, no problems or anything like that. And then it just helped me understand. I mean, why are you here? Did the university send you down? Did we request it?
You requested it.
Okay, thank you. I didn't know. Okay, thanks. So what about the is there any federal money at all that comes to you, you know, to respond to some of this? Or?
This is an unfunded mandate.
Okay.
Dealing with OCR. I mean, there are grants and things like that are competitive, but there's no here's the money you get to comply with this. So yeah, we're taking people from other areas and tasking them with doing this.
Thank you.
You can continue.
So UAF came forward, and just to finish that piece, to talk about these cases, they only wanted to do that after, in essence, we had our arms around the problem. We talked to the students involved, contacted them, reinitiated the process, and had an idea of the whole UA system. At this point, I'll just transition now to accountability. And I think the end of that story is what I just said to Senator Coghill, in that the proof is in the students coming forward and talking to us about us, and us being able to link those students with counseling, shifting their classes around, and keeping them in the educational environment. So there's been I've sensed a lot of criticism of Title IX, but that's a very good thing, that number of students are coming and we're able to keep them at school. But there has been...
So Mr. O'Brien, mm-hmm. when you say this huge increase, I think you said 400%, is this 400% of complaints about rape or other forms of sexual harassment that might not...
It's harassment in general, but the number of sexual assault, that component of it has gone up proportionally.
So last year, for example, how many allegations of sexual assault were there on the various campuses of University of Alaska?
Well, I can tell you, I'll just tell you this semester, that's the most recent data. At UAF, there was 15 sexual harassment complaints came in. So that's anything from flirting to rape. 8 of those were sexual assault allegations. At UAS, we had 4 allegations. One of them was sexual assault. And I have UA. At UAA, 59 complaints, 4 of them sexual assault.
Thank you. Representative Kamen.
So one of the critiques that I've read about, and we can take, for example, one of the... You have 59 sexual harassment complaints at University of Alaska Anchorage and 4 allegations of sexual assault. Of the sexual assault allegations, how many of those were reported to the police?
Well, that's up to the alleged victim. So necessarily none. There's no necessary requirement that these are reported to the police.
Follow-up. So...
It could be all 4 of them. I'm sorry.
But the university doesn't view their role if somebody in the administration has a report of sexual assault from a student perpetrated by another student. The university's view is that they don't have an obligation to report that to the police.
That's correct.
And follow up, it's strictly for then the student to either decide or not to decide, do I now report this to the police?
That's correct.
And continuing a little bit follow up, so the one of the critiques I've heard is frustration with students who come to the university, and this wasn't at the University of Alaska, it's just what I've read in the national media. A student complains to the university, this person raped me, and the student that is accused of the rape was given kind of a 1-year leave of absence from the university, and a year later they're back on campus, and there's this perception that the university has done nothing in allowing an alleged criminal to be wandering the grounds of campus. I guess my query is, how does the university manage this topic of not reporting it to the authorities and not, I guess, conducting some of an investigation, but not conduct, well, probably doesn't have the resources to investigate like the police department might investigate an allegation of sexual assault. How does the university kind of square those criticisms with saying, well, the victim didn't take it to the police, so I guess we're going to let this person back on campus?
That's a very difficult balancing act that we've been put into. We've been kind of put in that position through this guidance. For example, I've urged at the federal level for us either to have one or the other, either mandate that we report, because in the K-12 environment, you know, the idea of mandated reporters is something we've all heard of. The difference being these are adults, they're not children. Or you can imagine in that situation we don't report, because guidance is very clear that if, you know, we can urge the victim to, we can walk him or her over to the police station if they want, but we can't make them report. There's also a liability involved 2 years later when that perpetrator, alleged perpetrator, comes back and quote unquote, we've done nothing. So either we need a mandate to do something or a safe harbor when, because of the victim's unwillingness, we don't. Right now, we're between the horns of those two. We have the worst of both worlds in that we don't necessarily report, but that may tie our hands on how seriously we can act. But you can. But it illustrates why we have to be doing investigations ourselves. If someone sexually assaults someone, we need to, and they're not going to go to the police, we have to do a serious investigation, and if we find it to be accurate, we're most likely going to expel that person, so they're not coming back.
And
it's, I can follow up, but it seems like it's riddled with problems. I mean, take for example a couple who dated happily for 2 years, and they're both honor students at the top of their class and have great careers, and they break up, and in the midst of the breakup, one of them accuses the other of sexually assaulting them, you know, after the fact, and as a result, this person not only is expelled by an administrative finding by a preponderance of the evidence, but this person is expelled, and essentially their career, very promising career, is over.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, there's the risk that if it really did happen as alleged, there somebody else might be allowed to stay at school.
Yeah, you've just enunciated very, very eloquently exactly the position we're in. I mean, that's the conundrum that we're dealing with at the university, and we're doing the best we can. And you can imagine being a millimeter off in either direction can have very serious ramifications. So we take that very seriously. I've heard Representative Ledoux's criticism of the due process, but we look at these cases very, very closely. In the most serious cases, folks that are accused generally have counsel and do a good job of representing them. And it's a tough position, but it's a thicket we're fighting our way through.
So in the criminal system, the police have things like rape kits and forensics experts and trained investigators, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. How does the university do its investigation?
Well, obviously, we rarely on our own have access to that sort of criminal investigatory tools. Most, you know, UAA and UAF have their own police forces, so if the issue is reported, we have folks with that sort of training on campus. And Juno has JPD on campus. That's if it's reported to law enforcement, which, again, it may or may not be.
For example, is there a 24-hour hotline that they can report it to campus? I mean, suppose something happens late in the evening.
Right.
So is there a report? And then if somebody's reporting a rape, that the rape kit, I mean, because the rape kit could actually exonerate people, too.
I agree. So my career started.
Do you have that stuff that you use? So somebody doesn't want to report it to the police, but they say that they've just been raped. Do you do that kind of investigation?
So to answer your question, and you know, I spent many years as a criminal defense attorney, so I have many of the same concerns about this that you're expressing. One of the main goals of this guidance, and I'm not saying I agree with it or that I'm promoting it.
It sounds almost Orwellian.
Is that victims have tremendous control over what happens in their case. And if someone calls, and this is hypothetical, and says, I was sexually assaulted at 3 in the morning at a party, clearly the university is going to say to them, you know, we're going to do a risk assessment. And there are times where the victim could say to us, do nothing. I just want someone to know. I just want counseling. There are times where we're mandated to do something. We're never mandated to call the police. But if we're going to do an investigation, clearly we're going to say, you know, the best way to prosecute this, if that's what you want to do, is to get a rape kit, is to go to the police. We're not going to mandate that, though. In the end, you know, these are adults, and we're going to give the alleged victim that option. Laying out, the goal is to provide that person with a large menu of options, but, you know, not to take control and say, as you would in a K-12 environment, I need to report this. I'm a mandated reporter. That's not our environment. So, to get to the conclusion of your question, there are going to be times, perhaps, where we don't have the rape kit, and it would have been extremely persuasive one way or the other. But we can't order it. We don't have the folks on staff to do it, and we just won't have it.
Senator Cockham.
One other question, and I appreciate you explaining the conundrum to us. It's important that we understand what's going on in Alaska and how our students feel safe and how this system works. In Alaska, as legislators, we live under a pretty arcane ethics system. And yet, if we're accused of something, at least there's a committee that will take that under advisement. And it's confidential until such time as there's an accusation that can be shown credible. And so can you explain to us how that works? If there's an accusation, is it confidential until it's found credible? What is the process?
The starting at the top, in terms of suspension and expulsion, so that's the most serious action the university can take. Under Alaska state law, only the president of the university can suspend or expel someone. And by delegation under state law, the chancellor can do it. But state law also says it can't be delegated below the chancellor. So that's where it ends. The final decision whether to take that very serious action is at the highest level of the university. When an allegation of this nature comes in of sexual, so now turning to how it works through the system, an allegation is made. Maybe a faculty member comes in and says, a student told me this. The alleged victim will be contacted by Title IX investigators. These are folks trained in talking to alleged victims about this sort of conduct. They do an investigation. They'll find one way or the other, either by preponderance of the evidence, either that it's supported or not supported, that a violation of our student code of conduct in Title IX has occurred. That gets forwarded on to an office. If it's against a faculty member, it might go to HR. If it's against another student, it's going to go to our Dean of Students office. They're then going to do more investigation and come to a conclusion, which is going to be forwarded to both the accused and the complainant. All parties have an opportunity to present witnesses, meaning here's the people I want you to talk to, here's questions that I think you should ask the other side. There isn't a hearing, but there is scrutiny of the facts and the ability to present countervailing evidence. That, depending on the severity, but I'm going to focus on the most severe conduct, sexual misconduct, it is then forwarded to the vice chancellor level. So an executive within the university, who again gives students an opportunity to weigh in. Here's the conclusion that the university has come to involving discipline. You again have another opportunity to provide us input. That recommendation is then sent up to the chancellor. And depending on the matter, depending on the number of people involved, that review can take quite a while. This is an area where the guidance is that all of this is supposed to happen within 60 days to that first conclusion, which is very quick. I have to say, you know, we've done our best to meet that, but we often take longer, erring on the side of, well, let's take care of the alleged victim fast, but let's do due process slow to get the best possible, the most accurate possible outcome. So there's multiple levels of review before the chancellor, as I started with, is going to make that ultimate decision. Once that decision is made by the chancellor, if it's to suspend or expel someone, they're banned from all UA property for either the length of the suspension or for life if it's an expulsion.
Okay. And there's probably a dozen questions, but I know that we have the Department of Corrections
yes.
here, and we've burned up
this is,
our
this
time.
This has been such a fascinating, enlightening discussion. How much longer do you need for your presentation?
I can cede the floor to our my good friends at the Department of Corrections.
But Madam Chair, I would suggest, you know, we got about 25 minutes for the Department of Corrections just to give us a high-level view of some of the things.
Actually, this meeting's supposed to go to 3:30, so we have an hour.
You have an hour, I don't.
If I could just finish with one point.
Just let him make his statement, and then I'll...
And just in terms of accountability and being in compliance going forward, you know, this is an area, as I mentioned earlier, the regents have taken on. You know, ultimately, they run the university. They are looking very closely at Title IX. They've tasked President Johnson with twice a year reports on compliance, and along with more frequent updates on these specific problems. President Johnson is requesting and getting updates monthly from chancellors. So we're in a point where, you know, we've always been working with OCR and their audit, but we're not driven by their audit. We came forward on this. UAF came forward because it was the right thing to do. And the piece I just want to circle back to is the fact that students are responding is really the ultimate accountability, because they're our constituent, and their safety is our number one concern.
Thank you. Do you have a really quick question, Representative Grunberg, so we can go on to the Department of Corrections?
Yes. Did I hear you say that there's no statute or framework for dealing with these issues?
Well, there is much of the guidance I was referring to is simply guidance. Meaning it's not, it hasn't gone through rulemaking, it's not a federal regulation. It comes in the form of a letter, a dear colleague letter. So when there's a, say this, one of the most controversial areas was universities lowering the standard of proof in some cases to preponderance of the evidence. Congress didn't weigh in on that. The Department of Education didn't have hearings on that. That came in a letter from the Department of Education to us. Other areas.
Sorry, is that state or federal?
Federal. So other areas that are clearly codified as part of Title IX is a federal statute, and there are places that are in Code of Federal Regulations. But the vast majority of this guidance is not coming in. It's not being passed by Congress. It's just coming to us in our dear colleague letters, they're called, which are this informal way of requesting universities to follow certain Department of Education guidelines.
If I may. Madam.
One more follow-up, and then we've got to go to Department of Corrections, Representative Grunberg.
Go ahead.
And we have tremendous, you know, sexual assault and these issues have always been prohibited at UA, and we've had processes in place to deal with that for a very long time. So there is the sort of process a person has to go through before they're expelled or accused of this sort of thing is in our Board of Regents policy. So I'm not quite sure what you're referring to.
Let me get to what I'm referring
okay.
to.
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was a regent who was indicted mm-hmm. for misuse of federal funds.
Right.
He refused to resign.
Right.
There was nothing in place in the university to deal with this issue.
Right.
So after several years of considerable struggle, we managed to pass House Bill 6 that dealt with that. And some members who were sitting here were part of that process and remember it well, like poor Yorick, but not as mine. Is there going to be something formally that's put out on this, or need the legislature consider doing something like we did with House Bill 6 We gave every opportunity to the regents to deal with it themselves and only passed the legislation when there was nothing forthcoming from the university.
My reaction to that is that the university is leading on this subject. We've been changing our regents policy as fast as we can, which, as any big administration, is not a lightning speed. But we're trying to both get in compliance with Title IX's federal mandate without offending state law and the requirements of, that we think students in Alaska have by virtue of being residents. So we're working on it, and my answer is no. I don't think the legislature needs to take the lead on this because we're working dutifully on it.
Madam Chair, I would just hope they would keep us informed on what they're going to do.
We'll try to make sure that that happens. Thank you, Representative Gruner.
Madam Chair, if I might interrupt, I just wanted to notice the Senator Machicki has joined us. He's been here for about 10 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Coghill. A lot of parallel processes going on. I apologize for my lateness.
And I apologize for not noticing that you were in the room. Excuse me. Mr. O'Brien, thank you very much for coming down and presenting to us. And
I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. And I may follow up with you on a few things that we chatted with. And I see that Representative Millett has joined us.
Take care.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
So, at this point, we're going to change tracks and dive back into the Department of Corrections report. And so we have Commissioner Monaghan with us, and please come up and put your name on the record and begin. And I'd like to note that we also have a document on our desks from the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, and good afternoon. For the record, my name is Walt Monaghan. I am the interim commissioner for the Department of Corrections. What I would like to point out that I've been at the position just a little bit more than 2 months now, and so what you have before you is a bulleted kind of overview of what the actions we have taken since I've arrived. If it's all the same, let me just start to go down them, and if there's questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Since the report that was released by the governor's office that pointed out many of the issues that DOC is struggling with, we tried to follow these, what are on the items here before you, in the kind of the order we found them. So the policy and review updates, there was a lot of them that basically had not been addressed. We are working on them. We actually hired someone with the permission of the administration to become our policy coordinator, and he works directly for me. And he's got roughly, I want to say, 15 years total of experience in regards to being an HR manager for a large federal organization. So he's been very instrumental and has been working with many people to get them done, tweaking, adjusting, and also seeking out input. So we've hired a policy coordinator. He has completed 10 PNPs that are opened and under review, including the death of an inmate policy and procedure. We're working with the state, Washington State, and Oregon State Departments of Corrections because they have a lot of information that we feel that is very germane to what we're doing as well. The items that the next bullet is the organization structure of facilities. I know that there was a concern that was mentioned in the report regarding that. We'd like to look at, obviously, we're providing clear direction responsibilities for everybody that's working in the arena that DOC. But one of the things that was pointed out and was a very valid concern was that there was a lot of lines of communication that weren't open within DOC. It's a very closed organization and had been for quite some time. So we are opening those up because I don't think that's healthy. That's any organization that within itself becomes siloed is doomed to the failures that were so noted in the report. So,
Senator Cagio.
Thank you, Mr. Monaghan. Thank you for taking the interim job. Can you give us just an example of when you say lines of communication? Are you talking about different authority structures, different shift work, between facilities, between, you know, just give us an example of lines of communication that maybe you're trying to close the gaps on?
Well, a quick example, as noted that was in the report, is that there was not a clear communication between the medical staff in an institution and the correctional staff. And by bringing the two directors or the acting directors into a closer relationship and directing that everybody else starts communicating within is one of those kind of things that needs to be done. And I'll touch a little bit more about that particular example as we progress through the sheet. But quite honestly, when directors of various divisions within a department aren't talking, then we do have a problem. And that was one of the issues that we had found.
Thank you very much.
You can continue.
Yes. Okay. We're actually looking at some maybe possible restructures, but we're going to float those ideas and discuss them to see if we can become more efficient and effective in the most cost-effective manner. The next area was solitary confinement, which was certainly highlighted in that report. And we found that with the National Institution of Corrections, they have some training of which they're going to pick up the tabs on, and we're going to send some folks up there, as well as our review, our research review by the policy writer. He's actually done quite a bit on this as well, so we will have these folks when we send them on down there to be up to speed as possible, but we still hope to learn a lot more on this.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cogkill.
I used to be a representative, and thank you. Solitary confinement is particularly interesting to me because if there's a place where we have to segregate people, it's important, but it can also be one of the more inhumane ways of keeping people incarcerated because you just cut them off from everybody, and your time is very limited. Are you finding space limitations, or is it segregation issues for the most part?
Actually, that's an interesting. I can probably there was an example at one of our facilities, Goose Creek, for example. There had been a mod called Kilo Mod that where we basically kept all the sexual offenders separate from the general population because of the issues that they're not generally welcome within the general population, and for their safety, we had them off in a different area. However, due to the layout of that particular institution, in order to move one of the individuals, one of the inmates, from Kilo Mod to the area where they could see medical or see an attorney, we literally had to clear the entire yard, which had about 300-plus individuals at any one time. So he had to relocate all of them, lock them back up just to transport one person. So for that reason, we ended up kind of disbanding Kilo Mod and put those individuals in segregation for their own protection, their own safety. But it is it's an area that in segregation there are limitations on what you can have because this is not just their segregation. It's segregation that includes others. And you cannot allow one inmate to have more property in the same segregation area as another. So they have to follow under standard rules. And we're receiving complaints on that. But that's one of the things we're trying to look at. We want to make sure that everybody is safe, no one's preyed upon, no one's victimized, and at the same time, we have to look at the efficiencies of running the institution. So it is a matter of space. It's a matter of also cost effectiveness. So
I just wanted to highlight the issue because I'd heard some complaints drifting up my way.
Yes. As I have too, Senator. Thank you.
Representative Grunberg, and then Senator Costello.
Commissioner, we now have the formation of the Public Integrity Unit in the Department of Law, and you're one of three areas that the governor has focused this unit's attention upon. what do you envision your relationship being with that agency, or is it mostly going to be like an internal investigation unit in the police department or something? And in conjunction with that, you have listed here a list of things you are doing, but I don't see any prioritization. Could you please focus on both those?
Okay, on the first one, through the chair, the issue on the public integrity unit, what I see DOC or DPS's role or any other entity that would be involved in this is providing an individual who has knowledge and policies, procedures, and can act as a liaison for helping the integrity unit determine why we do things the way we do, and also, as well as accessing necessary documents or bringing interviews to bear. So I see that we become a supporting role or a compliance role, if you will. If that answers your question about the public integrity unit.
Well, please go ahead.
Okay. What we are looking at is establishing a standards officer, basically a professional standards officer who would be that person who would interface with the public integrity unit that help facilitate those duties I just described. And in regard
on prioritization, I don't want to not budget.
On the prioritization, there are what I really see. All of this, I mean, everything that's mentioned in the report, it kind of goes down to a central theme, that the central theme is change the culture within corrections. And everything that we have here, everything that we're doing, in essence, is trying to create the environment that we can affect that change. It starts with policies and procedures, it starts with training, it's screening, supervision, discipline, interactions with other agencies. So we are trying to work with everyone else to affect that change. Now, we can enforce change, but if we enforce it just merely by saying do it, it will not be as permanent and I think as sincere if the change comes from within. And I'd like to think that I've had some history in doing that with both the two other major organizations I've been a part of in the past. The changes that have to happen are not, they have to be obviously throughout the entire department. But I think what is not well delineated in the report or the review that the governor's office has done is that, though it does hint it, the vast majority of people that work for DOC are actually on top of their game. They're doing the right thing the vast majority of times. We're asked to supervise somewhere close to 11,000 people, I think, if you add up both the out in parole and probation as well as institutions. And we do that with about 1,500 folks. And so I would suspect that literally there are thousands of contacts every day between a staff member and one of our future returning citizens. And I would also suspect, because I've seen it in a couple of examples, that the interaction between the two is proper, is professional, and it's compassionate. The examples in the review do not show that, but it does, if you read in there, it does talk about things actually being done right. So my job, I see it as, is to make it all right so that the examples, the horrific examples that were highlighted in the report are done away with. Will there be future deaths in the facilities? Absolutely. We take on a population that have issues that have involved in substance abuse or other kind of neglecting lifestyles that basically shorten people's lives. And unfortunately, in many cases of prison deaths, it's just a matter more so of geography than anything else. The folks would pass no matter where they might be. But the ones that are preventable, the ones that we can identify, the ones we can intercede on and change that outcome, they're the ones that we have to work on, that we must work on. Because I agree, we shouldn't lose anybody that need not be lost.
Thank you.
Representative, or Senator Costello, and then Representative Klayman, and then Senator McChicky.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Commissioner, of the division directors that you have in the department and your position including, how many of those are currently in an acting capacity?
I want to say myself, and I have two director, well, actually one acting, the director of the institutions, and then we have a deputy director in charge of medical.
We're all acting?
Kind of. The one for institutions definitely is an acting one. The one that is the deputy director for our medical, mental health medical, she is a deputy, and there isn't, but she heads it, so that's about as, just three, I think, is to answer your question.
So those are positions that are then not considered permanent. And I know in your case I was reading that you're being considered for the commissioner position and the governor has a lot of faith in you. However, he's also perhaps looking. And my question is there a plan for making those positions permanent? Because it seems that with the types of issues that the department is looking at right now, that it would be in our best interest to have leadership that's actually in a permanent role.
The short answer is absolutely yes. The way I've picked my role, the way I see my role, even as an interim, is trying to address the issues as hard as I can, as fast as I can, for as long as I can. The governor does make the final decision, and he can pick anyone that he so chooses. But what I want to do is move the department as far forward to address the issues that have been brought up while I am still in the acting capacity. The other individual who is definitely in the acting has a wealth of experience. He's got 37 years with the Department of Corrections. And I am watching and trying to help guide him in regards to, I think, a more conducive behavior in regards to interaction with everybody, and I am seeing results. So it's a kind of a difficult place if you kind of like lop off the head of any organization completely, and where you lose a lot of the upper tier, if you will. You lose a lot of experience, and it makes everyone else nervous. So whatever has to be done should be done very precisely and with a lot of thought in trying to develop the best possible management team you can without with the least amount of disruption. So,
follow-up.
Go ahead.
My second question or topic is about solitary confinement. Are there national or industry guidelines in terms of the amount of time an individual should be in solitary confinement? And I know the example we've seen before, and also the juveniles who've spent 11 months in solitary confinement, it's troublesome, and I was just wondering, are there national guidelines that are recommended for that?
That is being explored, Senator, in regards to sending those folks down to the National Institution of Corrections, and as well as looking at the research that's already online. We agree with you. It should be used in more sparing disbursements than kind of wholesale. Some of these, basically, not everyone who's in solitary or what we call segregation is there because they've done something wrong. I mean, some actually seek that because they feel that they're, it's for protection against other inmates. So they're seeking a place to be. But in regards to juveniles, yeah, there's many studies that says it's not healthy for them to be there for long, especially in their developmental ages that they're undergoing. So we want and hope to learn how they can more properly be addressed. And just off the top of my head, without going into research, this is something I think it should be worked more closely with the Department of Health and Social Services, who normally run juvenile issues, that try to get their input as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. And Senator Machicki, you had a question.
I believe Senator or Representative Klayman.
Oh, was I going ahead of you? My apologies, Representative Klayman. Pull the mic over toward you, please.
And I want to go back to the topic of, or not go back, but continue on the topic of solitary confinement. You described what you're doing at the Goose Creek Prison, where you essentially took a group of sex offenders out of a Kelo wing, because when you took them for visitors or for professional visits, you essentially had to close the yard down and move everybody out of the yard, which creates an enormous management practice. But the solution was to basically take that whole population and put them in the segregation, or what we might more commonly describe as solitary confinement. And that, it seems like you're faced with two poor choices on both instances, because you've got a population, I'm assuming that your sex offender population in Goose Creek is more than one or two prisoners, and you're left with a management, more than a management challenge, because solitary confinement, especially for those who haven't requested it, it seems like a pretty harsh and maybe a little more than is needed. And is there some solution that is not going to put, I mean, it seems to me that people that are in segregation should be the minimum number necessary, and it sounds like you're not doing that. And I understand the management problems that you're presented with, but is there a solution in there that avoids some of those problems?
Through the chair, Representative, that in that particular instance, the when Kelo Mod was shut down, all the inmates were offered to go either to segregation or to general population. The vast majority chose segregation. And is it a workable solution? I think it's a temporary solution. Ultimately, one of the things when we talked about or I kind of briefly touched on the restructure of our facilities, it would make more sense to look at all of our facilities and see what we can actually break individuals into more compatible areas so that we can be as effective and as inefficient as possible. One of the things we find that we're getting a very large geriatric population that are in our facilities. Now, it would behoove us and our population to be closer to medical services should they need it. And so one of the things we're discussing, for example, is to dedicate one institution primarily just for geriatric ones. We have Highland, for example, is largely, in fact, it is all female, but it doesn't have all the services, I think, that a lot of the other facilities have in ways of medical support and whatnot. Just for the lack of the room size and the confines of the institution. So, again, perhaps maybe one of the discussions that we're looking at is maybe swapping out, maybe the geriatric goes to Highland, as since they're still fairly close to medical providers, and putting the females out in Palmer, for example, where they have more room and access to all the things that they do out there. That way we don't have all the institutions where all the internal restrictions on the co-ed institutions where you shouldn't have the genders so they can't view each other, in other words. And it does cause issues. So it's an active dialogue, I can tell you. We're trying to find a better way to fit our population in a way that it supports them as well as what we're trying to accomplish overall.
Thank you.
Senator Michicki, but before you begin, I want to note that Representative Lynn has joined us.
Again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Interim Commissioner, and this certainly isn't meant to impugn any DOC employees and officers. I think they have a challenging job, for sure. But the report discussed several outdated policies and procedures, and on that point, all Alaskans saw the disturbing videos. I mean, disturbing at best, heartbreaking at worst, right?
Correct.
So to understand where we've been, our segregation policies, solitary confinement policies, facility-specific, or is there a statewide policy and procedure that's sort of governing the entire system?
Policies are meant to be statewide. And what we do in the way of procedures is actually dependent on the availability of other resources. For example, having policies that are standard all across the 13 different institutions that we have, the ability to utilize community assets in there will be larger, for example, in Fairbanks, Juneau, and Anchorage than it will be in Nome. So what we are anticipating is that even though we mandate these policies, that the standard operating procedures for every for institution will be dependent upon the availability of community assets that can be tapped into. So if this is the law, these are the rules or the regulations that they would follow under. I hope I answered your question.
Follow-up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
And the reason I head in that direction, I don't know if it's an internal document or not, but could you share with the Chair at some point the existing policies? And the reason for my question is I'd sort of like to know, I mean, there's a chronic issue, and I know you're sending folks to training and managing restrictive housing populations, but what sort of acute policy changes have occurred since the report has? And if you don't have that today, if you can share them with the Chair, I'd just like to learn what we have done to ensure that we dramatically lower the probability of a recurrence.
I didn't bring it with me to the meeting. I apologize. I think I had it in a stack that's probably still on my desk, but I will get the ones that we have or that we are addressing. I can provide that when I return to my office tonight.
And, Madam Chair, that takes us to the bullet administrative criminal investigation. So that might give us a little more in-depth view of that if you want to continue to that point.
Representative Millett had a question first.
Thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I apologize for being late. I have an ethics committee also. My question is, you had talked about general population and segregated population. Can you give us a ratio of segregated and general population? What are we talking about when we're talking about segregated? What's the number? And then second part is, of that number, who is voluntarily segregated and who is mandated segregated? I think that those numbers are pretty profound, and so I think that would be a good discussion to have so we know what DOC is facing as far as, you know, the population differences, you know.
Okay. I don't have that with me at the moment. Let me check to see if my staff.
Do we have that?
Okay. We will get that to you.
Do you have a general, through the chair, do you have a generalization, or can you give us a 10% is segregated?
It would be just a guess on my part. So.
Representative Klayman.
Just a short follow-up on my colleague's question about people that are in segregation. It seems that the choices that you gave to prisoners that were in the Kilo Mod in Goose Creek is a little bit of a Hobson's choice. Choice one is to go into general population where at least anecdotally people that are convicted of sex offenses, particularly sex abuse of children, tend to get treated very, very poorly by their fellow prisoners. And that's probably a generous term for how they're treated. And so the would you prefer to go in segregation or prefer to go in general population is, it's not surprising that, quote, choosing segregation, but it doesn't seem like a very voluntary choice either. And so I'd be curious to see to the extent you can distinguish between voluntary and basically people that are being put in segregation because of their own behavioral issues, how many of those are kind of protection issues that may be partly driven by the lack of other options about where they might be housed and feel safe?
Actually, I think I can provide that fairly soon because I'm recalling an email because I asked that question. And I don't have that at my fingertips, but basically the number who wanted to go to general population was very few, and some of those changed to back into segregation. I really think that the answer isn't so much as that this is the final solution. The final solution is to find out how we can restructure perhaps the facilities so that we can accomplish what needs to be accomplished without extraordinary events or giving them that choice of either solitary or general population. So Kilo Mod was a great idea, and it provided a lot of support. It provided a location for training and whatnot, but it was probably the location was a poor choice in regards to movement of inmates from one section of the prison to the other.
And just a short follow-up, doesn't really require a response, but it is a little bit, not to overly focus on how you're managing sex offenders, but I know that's a significant portion of your long-term prison population. And I know Goose Creek is our newest facility, and it's a little frustrating to think of how much money we spent building that facility and to hear that design seems to have some problems that can't address some of the realities of the prison population and the notion that we need to go back and do some redesign of the facility itself, given how much money we spent to build that. Is, I know it didn't occur on your watch in Department of Corrections, but it's pretty frustrating, I guess, is the best I can say.
So let me see if I understand this. Over at the module, was you put all sex offenders in this module. So nobody was really being in solitary confinement. Is that correct?
Normally in the mods, if there's a lockdown, everybody does go back into their cells and things are locked up. But otherwise, in mods, basically for a percentage of the time, a significant percentage of the time, the doors are open and they can go out and play cards or go back in the room, take a nap. It's a fairly open communal area that they play cards or checkers or talk or watch TV or something along those lines. Solitary or segregation, that is more of the lockdown area where they're inside a lot, inside behind closed doors. And we do bring them out for things like showers and exercise, but that's just a couple hours a day, and it's not healthy, and that's one of the things that we want to look at and address for the vast majority of them.
But what I'm trying to figure out is when the sex offenders were at Goose Creek in the modules, were they actually in solitary confinement, or did you just group all of the sex offenders together?
It's that's why they call it a module. I mean, they're all it's like one block, and all the cells are inside. But for them, the doors were open most of the time. The outside doors, of course, are secured. But in regards to the movement inside, they were all sex offenders, and so they were quite comfortable and enjoyed a lot of liberties, like having their own MP3 players and whatnot, that they could kind of relax and be safe at. Because you're right, they don't play well with others as far as the general population is concerned.
But this model hasn't worked for?
It was a matter of convenience to the staff that we have. To move one, we had to clear the yard. To walk them across the yard, to go into either a medical situation or to visit an attorney or visitors that come in. So it's it perhaps can be resurrected if we look at the and reallocate, so to speak, the availabilities within the institution, that and all institutions. But that will take time.
All right. Thank you. One more thing with respect to solitary confinement. Are you still putting juveniles into solitary confinement?
Yes, because of the requirement not to be with the general population. We don't want them victimized. And so for their protection, they are in segregation. The area that needs to be explored, I think, more readily than others. I think only because I don't want, there's the real, and the report points this out, there's a real strong correlation between individuals who spend a lot of time, especially in their formative years, that they will really be handicapped when they try to return to society. And we don't want to groom them to be, give them more problems than they went in with. So we do need to do something with youth, and that's why I want to work with the Department of Health and Social Services and tap their expertise and see what we can do on that.
So don't we put the youth in McLaughlin? I mean, so why would the youth be in the regular prison system outside of McLaughlin?
Well, it is my understanding is that once they're convicted as an adult, the years ago, that actually was the practice. When somebody was convicted of homicide, for example, at 14, they would stay at NYC for up until they hit a certain age, and if they still had time to serve, then they'd go beyond that into an adult situation. But I think that was changed some time back. I'm not sure why. And I could be totally wrong on that. I mean, but that is my experience and my understanding back in my days when I was a cop.
So would there be any impediment to convicting somebody of an adult crime as an adult, but still when the court decides or the Department of Corrections decides where they're going to be placed, rather than place them in solitary confinement at an adult prison, placing them into McLaughlin?
That needs to be explored, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to continue to look into that because I do think it needs to be some middle ground. Where they're at now, I personally feel is not a good place. But
not if they're in solitary confinement.
I agree.
So somebody who is convicted at 14 as an adult, for example, and let's say they're convicted for, they're sentenced to 4 years. They spend 4 years in solitary confinement.
Well, I'm going to have to go to a lifeline if you don't mind.
Do we know? Thank you.
Hi, Diane Casto, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections.
Thank you.
So the clarification regarding youth is that there are, hold closer, that there are statutes that require once they are convicted as an adult, then there are statutes, which I do not know off the top of my head, that require them to be placed in adult facility. When they are placed in an adult facility, some of them are in segregation, but with most of the youth, we try to group them so they're more in a area where it's the youth as opposed to being in general population. So, for instance, in Anchorage Complex, there's a certain area where the young people that are under 18 live. They have schooling, they have certain activities, but they are kept separate from the general population.
Thank you. Representative Klayman?
With regard to those youth, is there a distinction between those that are being held pretrial? These are youth that are being waived into adult court for criminal purposes. Are those that are charged but not convicted, are they also brought into adult facilities, or are they kept in McLaughlin, or is there some are in McLaughlin and some are in adult facilities?
My understanding, and again, I've only been with Department of Corrections a short time as well, so I don't have a depth of information, but my understanding is that much of it depends upon where they are in the process. So if they've been convicted as an adult, then they go into the adult system. If they have not yet been fully convicted and sentenced, then there could be some movement between McLaughlin and our facility, is my understanding. But majority of the youth in our facility are those who have been convicted.
Thank you. You want to proceed, Commissioner? Chair,
on this point.
Pardon me?
On this point.
Go ahead.
As I understand it, if they're waived to be tried as an adult and they're convicted, then they're put in the custody of the Commissioner of Corrections. And if they're tried as a juvenile, they're put in the custody of the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. So it's an entirely different treatment program, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. If they are in the custody of Health and Social Services, they would be within one of the DJJ facilities. If they are convicted as an adult, they would be in the care of the Commissioner and within a DOC facility.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Proceed.
If there are more questions like that, I'll probably. Thanks. I think where we left off was the administrative and criminal investigations. You know, since the report, if there are some good things that actually came out of the report that were almost spontaneous. We were contacted by the Department of Public Safety, and they have assigned, when we have a inmate's death in the facilities, they will now assign the Alaska Bureau of Investigations to handle the criminal aspect of the investigation, which is fabulous, really. Prior to that, the troopers would send whoever was on patrol to the nearest facility, and they would do a investigation there, and I think that was kind of highlighted in the report as well. So we're having individuals who are specifically geared to look for critical information, look for critical evidence, and do all the right things in regards to determining what happened for a criminal case. And what we would do when there is a death in the facility, ABI, or the Alaska Bureau of Investigation from the troopers, will be responding, but we will also send a team to handle the administrative aspects and look at what we have done in regards to the policies, procedures, the training, or if there is an action or inaction by a staff member, and try to make a course correction with them, we will do that as well. We're trying to do this independent of the criminal, because we are not involved in the criminal aspects of it. We want to make sure that whatever was done properly, or if not properly, what we have to do to address it and fix it. So on the same vein, one of the things that I had mentioned earlier was a professional standards position.
Excuse me, Commissioner Bolana again. This Alaska Bureau of Investigations, is this part of the public integrity section? This is something that's been there for?
This is a division within the Alaska State Troopers.
Okay.
Or unit, rather. So.
Thank you.
When I came on board, one of the things I was kind of surprised at was that, and it's part of the issues that the report came out with, was the fact that we don't really necessarily have a centralized way of looking at all the complaints that came in. And when I was with the Anchorage Police, we invested in a program that we all had pored over and looked at. It's a commercial product that's off the shelf, and so it's not, doesn't have to be tweaked and made very personalized. But it captured all the complaints and the subsequent investigations on that into one particular program, and we called it the Tarnished Badge. I think that was the name of that particular program. It worked so well for us that the troopers, they adopted it as well. And so we would like to be the third organization that picks this same program up. So the idea is for standardization and uniformity, this particular program has the ability to record complaints no matter where they come in from, concerns, and who investigated it, and put down the subsequent information or investigation information that came out of it. One of the pluses that I liked about it is that if you make it available for viewing from the sergeant level on up, not only did it look at what was else was being done by whomever handled a similar kind of complaint, but as far as a managerial aspect of it, it gave us the ability to see who the active investigators were. If I had a sergeant, for example, that had been on working for 2 years and we'd never seen a complaint documented by that particular sergeant, that's a red flag for us to go talk to that sergeant. So it's a good system, and so we were exploring to see what we can do here in a correctional institution. There's they sent us packets and information. It's been adopted by many correctional institutions across the country, so we're looking for something that's that will give you those ready answers when you ask. The next bullet point was the coordination of other agencies. Again, it was primarily the, in the beginning, I mentioned about how siloed and shuttered the Department of Corrections were, and where we didn't want to play nice with hardly anybody, including ourselves. The opening up our dialogue with the other agencies that are listed in here helps undo that. It helps and forces us to be, as what the governor wants, to be more open, more transparent, because when you have a shuttered system, a silo, if you will, that doesn't play well with anybody, to include the public, that certainly is a breeding ground of distrust and suspicion. So we want to change that. We want to open up and be as open and frank and cooperative with the agencies that you see that are listed in here, and work cooperatively, because we share the same population in many cases. The leadership challenges. Again, I kind of opened with that my job is to manage the cultural change, and that has a variety of different things. It talks about everything that this report has, everything that from things like training and supervision and discipline, right down to even, we're looking at, it's actually saving money, but uniform changes that put everybody in the same uniform. Currently, if you're a correctional officer 1 and 2, you have a dark blue uniform. Then light blue goes to sergeant, then white goes to lieutenant. Well, they may have been done that way for a certain reason, I'm not sure, but we're going to save money and put everybody in dark blue and unify. And it's one of those things that coaches do on sports teams. They do something different to the uniform to help start that cultural change that they're trying to see in their team. That's what we're doing as well. Plus, it saves money. It's a handy thing. But I want to work with normalizing our relationship with all our unions and the other agencies, open up the dialogues. There's a contractual agreement that we have with a labor management committee with one particular unit, with one particular union, and we're going to work with them in a cooperative and manner, because good ideas can come from anywhere, and we want to capitalize on that. The next bullet point is Title 47, it's protective custody. This is the tragic situation that was exampled, unfortunately, with the deaths. But fortunately here, being part of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, we're going to get a big boost by some of the things, because it's also on the agenda for that. And whatever we can conclude, we're certainly going to want to see that incorporated at Department of Corrections. But primarily, one of the things that we can do immediately is try to work with the communities and the law enforcement that our facilities are in, and see how we can develop a more open communications. In fact, one of the success stories I've heard so far has been here in Juneau, where there was a meeting between the Juneau Police Department, Bartlett Hospital, and other community assets to see what we can do to examine the correct usage of Title 47. And so far I understand that the actual commitments have dropped down almost by half. So that's a good thing,
so
when people are pulling together.
Going to interrupt you here, Representative Mellett, and then did you have something?
Just a clarifying point.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Commissioner. I should have asked this before you went into Title 47. One of your bullet points is normalization of relationships with unions and other agencies. What issues are you having? I mean, what kind of specific issues that... I mean, I imagine morale is incredibly low because of this report, and you know, I imagine that's something that management practices will have to fix, but what other items... Well, is there a disparity over with the unions?
I think, without trying to point fingers, that in prior administrations, the relationship between management and union management deteriorated to the point where there was actually a vote of no confidence for one of the commissioners. And when you have that kind of adversarial relationship, sometimes you spend a lot of energy, a lot of emotion, fighting the wrong fight. And again, part of my past experience, when I want to try to implement the same kind of communications and relationship building that I had success with, when I became the chief at Anchorage, for example, Anchorage Police Department, I inherited 44 union grievances. When I left, I had four. Two of them were against me, the other two were against the city. But it's the idea that you want to work and develop, because the mission's the same for the union as well as for the management in the vast majority of cases. How we get there sometimes is the sticking point. But I want to work with all those for the same reasons about opening communications, start building that trust. These are the things I want to try to do and return and take this issue of animosity off the table. And so that's what I'm talking about when I'm talking about normalizing relationships with labor unions, for example.
Thank you. Apologize for skipping back.
Senator Cockham.
Just on the Title 47 issue, just for those who are listening in on this, it talks about protective custody. So give us an idea, top level, Title 47 means what?
The Title 47 actually is in two areas. Title 47 is individuals who the community finds, usually law enforcement, that feel that they are a danger to themselves because of either intoxication, which is one, or substance abuse, you know, it could be drugs, or they maybe are demonstrating perhaps mental illness to the point where they look suicidal or very aggressive. And so the law under Title 47 allows that peace officers to take individuals like that and or doctors and remove them to a place of safety and treatment if possible. So what Title 47 does is, especially in the vast majority of our cases, it's more of the issue of intoxication, either by alcohol or by drugs, that we don't want them... individuals to stumble out in the street and be harmed. So technically, what how it's supposed to, was designed, is that individuals who are found that way are first asked by law enforcement, where do you live? Where can we take you home? Is there somebody that can take care of you? If there isn't, or if there is a pressing medical issue that is with them at the time, they take them to the hospital and have them evaluated, because there may be something that's ongoing that could be, instead of being intoxicated, could be somebody who's having a disease issue, you know, diabetic kind of issue. So having them examined to make sure that there's no immediate harm physically, medically to them, but hospitals can't hang on to them. So it boils down to that the next available safe place for them to be is an institution or a jail. And for the intoxicated, it is a maximum of 12 hours, and that is pointed out very strongly in the report, which I agree with, that if an individual becomes coherent, can talk and walk in less than a 12-hour period, then they should be cut free. It's they did nothing to violate the law. They should not be in jail. It's just a place for safety for a while. The issues on the mental health, that's a different issue. Someone needs to be examined by folks who actually are competent in being able to do the right diagnosis on that and subsequent treatment if that be possible. But again, we're just should be just a holding spot until that availability comes through. So did I answer your question?
Yes, and Madam Chair, I just wanted to let people know this has been a discussion of civil liberties throughout the making of this law, that when can you detain somebody for their own safety, and when is that civil liberty under this civil law able to be used, and we've debated it here. I just wanted people listening in to know that we're not just going out detaining people, but there has to be good reason for it, and it's been hotly debated here in these halls, I can tell you that. So I just wanted to bring it up because we ran over the Title 47 as if it's no big deal. It is a big deal.
It is a big deal, and I apologize if I did that.
No, we talk in acronyms here sometimes that we've hotly debated, but people listening in need to get the benefit of a better explanation from time to time. So thank you.
So, Commissioner, we're actually over time right now. How long do you think it's going to take for you to do the other two bullet points? Or we could have you come back some...
I can do it real quick. Like the training and evaluations, we're actually starting to implement that now. A couple of things that we wanted to do. There was an unfortunate situation that was narrated again in the report. And the first thing, as a former law enforcement, that I thought of was that either a condition called excited delirium or positional asphyxiation, something that we learned tragically because of situations like this. So we're going to make sure that that is heavily hit within our academy. Not only that, we're going to in-service training to make sure all our staff is brought up to speed on that as well. And the other thing, just to help the communications, the last thing I want to bring up is that when a correctional officer, whether they've gone to the academy or not, and the Alaska Police Standards Council allows us to hire somebody and put them to work with a modicum of training without going to the academy up to 14 months. Police officers are the same way. But they need to know certain things. And one of the things I want, and we're doing now, is that when you graduate from the academy, you're going to spend 2 weeks with the medical staff at the hospital, so you can better understand what they're up against, and you will work better as a team and open communications, develop relationships, and forestall some of the issues that that report highlights. So we are working on it, and this is a process. It's not a project. It is a process. So I appreciate your time, and if there's any other questions.
I have one more question, Commissioner Monaghan. I've heard rumors that the Anchorage jail gets so crowded sometimes that people are actually sleeping in an outdoor enclosure, like without a roof. Is there any substance to those rumors?
Not they're not outdoors. I think that there's a the incident you were talking about kind of stemmed from the Fairbanks Four. Is that the I heard?
No, I didn't mention anything about the Fairbanks Four.
Okay, well, in there was a situation basically that, of a concern that the individuals were being housed outside. What I was assured is that the area that they were temporarily put in was certainly all enclosed, but it lacked the heat that the rest of the institution had. So once that was done, yes, in fact, they were there, we relocated everybody. So
it had a roof over it, but
yes.
it had no heat?
Right.
Even in the winter?
Correct.
That must have been really cold.
The temperature was like in the mid-50s, I understand, and which is still too cold. And so once it came to our attention, we had it moved. We had it addressed. And that's part of the training and the culture that we're trying to address.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you, committee. And it is now 3:35, and I want to remind members that our Wednesday meeting is going to be another joint meeting. It will begin at 1:30, and we will be hearing from the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's report. So thank you, and we are adjourned.